Hi, I'm Linda from Little Farmhouse Flowers.
And I'm Emily from Bonchop Flowers.
And this is the Frost on Flowers podcast, where we dig into the hustle of cool climate cultivation.
Thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoy today's episode.
Welcome to the third episode of the Frost on Flowers podcast. In this episode, Emily and I are considering how we are presenting our products to the outside world. We're thinking about photography and social media marketing and how our customers are also enjoying the flowers in their own homes, specifically tulips, since that's what we're working with and thinking a lot about for this segment of the podcast. And in that vein, we invited artist Kristen Sharda to come onto the podcast and share with us her inspiration in still life botanical photography. So we hope you'll take some time and check out her work on Instagram and online too, and just really enjoy this conversation as we dig deep into all the things that inspire her, light and nature and history, and we kind of unpack her work, which both Emily and I find so inspiring. So we hope you enjoy this conversation. And be sure to share your questions and comments in the captions on Instagram or with us by email at frostonflowerspodcast@gmail.com. And now, on to the podcast.
Okay, so welcome everybody. And today I've got Emily here with me, and we have a special guest, Kristen Sharda. And she is a photographer, and she works with botanical elements and creates these really gorgeous works of art. And we met a couple of years ago at a workshop in Toronto, where Kristen was teaching with another Kristen, Kristen Giel, cultivated by Kristen on Instagram. And I went there to learn both floral design and photography from the Kristens. And it was so amazing. It was so much fun. And I learned an incredible amount about Dutch masterworks too, and about arranging. And it was so much fun. So welcome, Kristen. We're so excited to have you here today.
Thank you so much, Linda, for inviting me. Thanks a lot, Emily. It's really great to talk to you guys. Anytime I can talk about flowers, I'm happy to do it.
So, Kristen, can you tell us a little bit about you and like where you're working and how you became an artist, or what brought you to the art form that you're now creating?
Yeah. So I've always been a photographer. I got a scholarship to go to school in photography in Denver, Colorado, at a commercial art school. It was a great experience for me to move away from home and live in another city. I snowboarded with my friends there and learned photography. And so from there, I moved to Vancouver and became sort of an assistant, which is like a step that a lot of photographers do. You work with other photographers to learn the business and to learn how to work on set and that kind of thing. And then when I decided to sort of go into business for myself, I moved back to Toronto because sort of the major businesses in Canada are mostly focused in Toronto. And my family was here, so that was the main reason. And then I didn't feel ever super comfortable as a commercial photographer. I don't know. There wasn't a lot of room. There's not a lot of room to make mistakes, of course, because you have to produce work that is professional, of course, which I did. But there was not a lot of room to be creative or explore at least the kind of work that I was being asked to do. So I got away from commercial photography for a while, and I worked in a yoga studio, and then I had some kids. I have three kids. And I found, sort of to my surprise, that when I was at home with the kids, that there was the kind of urge to do something creative, but not a lot of time to time to like rent a studio or get equipment or a lot of time for the production side of it. So I just kind of was working with the things around me. So I had a little garden, I have some, you know, hand-me-down things for my family. And I started putting together these still lifes, which is kind of a creative process that I found myself kind of revisiting over the COVID year, because, you know, everyone's in the same situation. You have these real constraints, you know, you can't be around a lot of other people. It's hard to be on set. So it was a, you know, I found that the time during COVID was kind of similar to the time when I was at home with my kids. So it wasn't an unprecedented experience. It does, you know, it does, you know, being sort of, you know, at home, I think all the time sort of help, you know, it makes you want to reach out for something to fulfill you. And I am, and on that, I think that's what I was doing. So I was doing these little setups and I was photographing them with my iPhone, and my husband, who's also a photographer, said, "You should get out the professional camera and start taking pictures," which I knew how to do. So I started doing that, and then I would produce these still lifes, and then I could, with the professional camera, I could print them really large. Brought you up to almost the present moment. I've been doing this probably for about, I don't know, 4 years, 5 years. I lost track. The process is the same. I wait until there's flowers blooming in my garden or in that in the area. So I work with some flower farmers in the area, and I get some of their product. I work with hand-me-downs from my Dutch immigrant family for props, and it's sort of, I've over the years I've added layers to that still life process. So now I sort of got involved in you know, the local flower farming idea. So I don't go to the florist in February and get, you know, roses from Argentina. I only use flowers when they're blooming in Ontario, which is a super short growing season.
We can sympathize with that for
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, exactly.
So I have this sort of season that I shoot in. And so then I started thinking about what else was happening in nature during that time in Ontario, and specifically in Toronto. So I thought about birds making their nests. I thought about snails and insects and butterflies and moths and you know, the larger animals. We see coyotes and foxes in downtown Toronto now. And you know, cats. And they're all kind of integrated, but mostly ignored because it's very urban, it's downtown. So not everyone sees that all the time, or we don't notice it. So I sort of brought all of those things that interact with the flowers in the garden, in a way that sort of makes a portrait of a time. You know, I have a couple of days to work with the flowers. I like to work with them right at the end of their peak. So yeah, so they're most open, the most just before they fall apart. So I have a really short shelf life when I'm working with them, a short time that I can work with them. Portrait becomes, or the photograph becomes a little bit about the time that it's happening and the very specific time that it's happening. That I'm putting it together. So if I miss it, like if I use magnolias, which have a really short life, and I don't really, you know, if it doesn't work out, then I have to wait till the next year to do the picture again. The pictures that I make, I add in, you know, if they're tulips or magnolias, I'm adding in nests and birds and things like that. If it's dahlias, you know, later on I'll add cicadas and bees and that sort of thing. So it's a little bit more than a still life. It's almost kind of a environment. Some of the other things that I add into the pictures are like birds, and I really, you know, it just, that seems really vital to me to add into these environmental pictures because they're all around. But I can't use things that move because my shutter speed is so slow. So the birds that I put into the still life are dead. And the way that I get these birds is from our Natural History Museum in downtown Toronto. They lend them to me. And they're birds that are found in the city that have hit tall office buildings and have died. So I borrow them for my still lifes. Not all still lifes have those birds in them. Everybody has a different reaction. Some people are a little bit put off, I think, by having dead things in the photograph. But it's a really important part of the passing of time, and it's also an important aspect of nature and life. So I didn't want to leave that out. Yeah. So I there you go.
Yeah.
It's
That's
just
great.
a really, really interesting process. It's so I've seen your work, and I whenever I see it, I'm my eye just kind of scans every single centimeter of your images and trying to figure it out and understand why you put things together. So hearing about your process is really, really interesting and rich to get that background of how you're coming to those compositions. It's really, really interesting. And I understand the bit about maybe some people not being as enthused about the dead birds, but as you described, shooting the flowers as they're very much like at their tipping point, they're at their fullest bloom. It's like they're almost on the end of their life and incorporating that other piece. I think that's really beautiful to document that all together. And like you said, this is like the circle of life. So it's really interesting to get all that background. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, no problem. It's an ongoing, curiosity for me. I'm really curious about nature, about science, about how things interact with each other and affect each other, and the interrelationship of all living things. It's a constant, learning process for me, for sure.
I just love all the details, how you can really take time with your work as a viewer, as someone who's enjoying it, and you have this experience of exploration. Like Emily was talking about, you get sucked in and you want to like look at all and you want to find all the little details and you're like, what else is hidden in here? What it's like an it really is a whole experience, a whole, way to kind of enjoy your work, and it's very thoughtful and meditative and it's really beautiful. So,
Thanks. Yeah. And I know
yeah.
that Linda had the opportunity to take your workshop, and when she told me she had signed up for it, I was like so close to trying to go with her because I had seen your work and just felt so inspired by it. And then Linda and I went to the Netherlands together, and I remember asking you a little bit, like especially when we were in the Rijksmuseum, a little bit about Kristen's work. And I just wonder, like, obviously, nature and time you've just described are inspiring you, but are you inspired by the Dutch masters? You've said you have some family history there, so just curious about how that plays into your work.
Yeah, I think the reason why I'm interested in the Dutch masters is their mastery and rendering of light. As a lifelong photographer, you spend time watching light in different situations, in different atmospheres, at different times of the day, how they, how light interacts with certain kinds of materials, and just the science of light is also super interesting to me. And the Dutch masters were working at a time when science was, science was also come was a fascination of theirs. One of the Dutch masters that I'm really interested in is Rachel Ruysch. I hope I'm saying her last name right. She was a painter in the 1600s. She was also a mother, and her parents were botanists. So her interest in what she was painting was inspired a little bit by the scientific work that her father was doing. And they owned a place where they kept plants and they studied them. And there was also other Dutch masters that worked with scientists who were working on microscopes, and they were artists, but there was so much science sort of coming to the fore that they were also scientists and discoverers. And there was all kinds of new plant life and new animals and new insects that were being brought from other countries, that they were doing some exploring. There was a lot of, I mean, the other side of that, I always think about there's the one side and there's the other side. The other side is that it was very exploitative, and I don't want to forget that. But they were learning so much. And that's incorporated into the paintings. So, you know, they were interested in science, they were interested in the science of light, and they were interested in the science of paint and how paint could be used in order to render that light. And I use kind of the same like the same techniques that they did. I have a window. It's actually lighting my face right now. And it shines on the flowers, and I photograph them with a digital camera. But it's the same sun that they used. It's the exact same lighting source that they had there. So there is a similarity. It looks like there's, and I do that on purpose, the photograph kind of looks like a painting, but it's not, it's a photograph, but then you kind of go back and forth, and I like that because it's one more thing that will kind of draw you in to look a little bit closer. So I like that. I like how the Dutch masters use light, and I try to imitate that feeling, I guess. This past season that I was shooting, I thought a lot about Rachel Ruysch, because one of the forms of painting that she liked to work in is called Sotobosco. So she really painted flowers, you know, but she would love to paint the back of a poppy, and she loved to paint like the leaves and where they've fallen on the ground, and moss, and like leaves bitten by insects and slugs and millipedes and the things kind of feeding off of the flowers after they die and turning them into compost. And that idea of compost and kind of things falling apart and degrading a little bit was definitely something that I was thinking about this year. Besides the fact that she was a woman, a professional woman in the 1600s with a family, like a big family, is she's a pretty fascinating character.
I've got to look her up now.
Yeah,
I'm
for sure.
intrigued. I'm gonna be doing some Google wormhole
I can send you a
searching,
good article
deep
about her,
dive.
actually.
Very cool.
I'll do that, yeah.
I guess this question's sort of on a in a similar vein. We're talking about like decay and things breaking down, and I love when I see those little, I don't know, it's like a little bit of the darker side in your work too, you know? Like at first it looks, you might, I don't know, at first glance to see all these beautiful flowers, and then you start to get in deeper and you find intriguing little bits, and then, you know, maybe there's something that is a little bit dark or dead or different. But kind of curious for our viewers to learn how your work may be informed or maybe changing due to, you know, other like man-made problems in our environment, like pollution or climate change or things like that. Are they playing into how you're thinking, or do you find your work kind of developing over time based on these other issues that aren't so beautiful, I guess, in a way?
Yeah, absolutely. Every season, I find that over the winter, I kind of have these ideas, and I do a little bit of research, and I look at paintings, and things come up for me just coincidentally. So last year, I was thinking a lot about Rachel Ruysch and her Sotobosco paintings. But the year before, I was very much thinking about I love contrast, and I was thinking about plastic, and so those two things sort of came together in my still lifes, as I started to look around in the spring just before I started to get to work. I noticed that when the snow melts in the city, there is a ton of garbage left over, and it's not always ugly, but it's mostly ignored. Again, people just sort of walk by it. But one of the things I noticed that was happening is that the bare trees would catch these sort of like these trails of clear plastic and sort of blow them around, and they were actually kind of beautiful, like ribbons or like clouds, like cirrus clouds. And so I collected some of that, and I started to add that into my still lifes. But I mean, my first attraction was just how it caught the light. But then, as I started to sort of realize what I was doing, I was collecting this garbage. There's a real contrast in the photos between the natural items, the nests, the birds, the eggs, the flowers, of course, that will turn into compost. They'll turn into nothing. The plastic will never do that. It will stay on forever and ever. So I started to add that a bit into my still lifes. I try to avoid, I don't want to be making a bus shelter ad that says don't litter. It's more of a, an artistic or curious exploration of these materials and how they are so different from each other. The flowers fall apart and the plastic will stay with us forever. And the flowers just come up in spring naturally, and the plastic is kind of left behind by us and all the things that we do. When we order something from Amazon and it comes in a million different pieces of plastic. So that one year I did a whole series that I called the plastic series, and there are all the garden flowers, but there's always a bit of found plastic in each of the still lifes. Some there's a lot and you can see it and it's very obvious. Some it's just a little bottle cap or something. But yeah, I was, I think as a citizen, if you're half awake, the climate crisis and the all the plastic that's washing up on the shores is something that we both have to think about and can't, we just can't wrap our minds around it, right? Or we would lie down in a little ball and cry. So this is a way for me to kind of integrate the idea of climate crisis and plastic and that kind of thing into my work, into myself, and a way to sort of think about or get sort of wrap my head around it.
So Kristen, you explained that you use the light right there from your window. Is that your workspace, your studio space? And I guess I'm also curious, you talked about how things are like the flowers are kind of at their end, the most full, about to tip, into kind of falling to pieces. I'm also really curious, like, how much time do you spend with each piece? So if you were to put it together, over how much time are you photographing that and watching the light change, and what does that process look like?
Well, because we're on Zoom, I can show you my workspace. It's so unbelievably unimpressive. I don't know if you can see it. It's just there's my bed, and there's the window, and there's my bedside table, and that's it. That's my workspace.
It's so amazing to see it, because I've heard you talk about that, at the workshop before, that it's just your bedside table. That's it. You have a stack of books there, and that's amazing. I think so many people, they see your art, and it's so magical. It's so incredible. And as a former art teacher, I heard that a lot from students who are trying to learn, who are trying to figure things out. They feel like there's some kind of magic involved, but obviously there's a lot of hard work, but that's not magic. That's your bedside table. And now we're going to take a quick break for a message from our sponsor. This episode of the Frost on Flowers podcast is brought to you by the Netherland Bulb Company. Family-owned and operated on both sides of the Atlantic for more than 35 years, the Netherland Bulb Company is a wholesale supplier of premium Dutch bulbs and bare root perennials. All of the Netherland Bulb Company's products are grown and shipped directly from their farms and packing facilities in Holland to their customer service and distribution centers in Pennsylvania to ensure their customers always receive superior service and quality. For more information about the Netherland Bulb Company, check out their website, www.netherlandbulb.com, and follow them on Instagram and Twitter at Netherland_bulb and Netherland Bulb Company on Facebook. And now back to the podcast.
I loved what
Yeah,
you were
you.
saying about when you were an art teacher and kids all thought that you had to have something extra, like a studio space, or you had to be somehow more in order to get work done. And I've really found that what often gets me going is that I just start and I never ever have the right things at the right time. I always have to make do all the time. And I think that works really well because you teach yourself as you go along and then you figure out how to, you talked about this in the last podcast, you know, if you just jump in, you learn mm-hmm. so much and you can kind of, you know, jerry-rig something. You can kind of MacGyver something into what you need mm-hmm. it to do. Like one of you was talking about the house that you made of hay bales and you froze them. It was amazing.
I know exactly what you mean. It's like that creative process. Like you start with something and you realize you can pull something else in. And only then, like, it's almost like the need to figure something out and not have everything in front of you brings you to that state of flow, right? Where like your brain can just go to like, this would be awesome. This would be awesome. Whereas sometimes I feel like if I have, you know, endless amounts of materials, it doesn't come organically and naturally to me. But that piece where you have to be like constantly like really digging and searching in your brain, what would be the next best thing creates that, at least for me, that's where like my flow comes from creatively, whether it's, you know, MacGyvering something together, like you said, or putting flowers together artfully. It's that like, it has to like that organic, you know, creation.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Sometimes I think that there's kind of, you know, like octopus have brains in their arms. It's almost like as soon as I start working with my hands, I will, mm-hmm. it will bring in information that I cannot figure out on my own. You know, it's really interesting. It's really interesting to go to actually just start and go through the process of teaching yourself. And you don't even, you don't even know you're learning really, but you're just solving one problem after the other. And then mm-hmm. you come up with right. solutions that no one ever could have told you. And you maybe couldn't even have Googled, you know? So right. yeah, it's exactly the same as that. That I think my process is exactly the same as yours. I have a curiosity about what if I add this, or what does this mean, or how is it different at this time than this time, or you know, why are tulips different to work with than dahlias? I don't know. And then you receive these answers that no one else could discover because it's you doing the work to figure it out. So my space, my studio space is unbelievably, plain to maybe make room for those, unexpected discoveries and, creative, insights and, just the process of working with natural items. Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like that, like knowing what your workspace like, it's this little bit of insider information. like people see your work. Mm-hmm. I see your work and I'm like, oh, but I know where she makes that. Like I know where that amazing, that little corner in her bedroom was where this came, was born. It's special. It's really neat. Cool. So Emily and I have been on this tulip kick, as you gathered from the first two episodes. And we're both a little bit of tulip fanatics, and we have to, you know, part of our job is figuring out how to talk to people about tulips and market tulips and answer their calls when they're curious about why tulips are behaving the way they behave. And we see, you know, obviously that flower appears in your work quite a bit, and we're really fascinated by how you decide to work with it and what sorts of challenges this particular flower creates for you. And we're just we're curious to know, but sometimes, you know, people who have only brought very conventional supermarket tulips into their home, they're always stick straight tall, and they maybe not even, they won't even open that much, you know, because they were cut so early, and they just kind of these perfect little soldiers in the vase. And That's not the kind of tulip we see in your work. That's not the kind of tulip we sell that we grow for our local customers either. So we're kind of curious to learn more about how they play into your work, since that's our little theme for these first episodes.
So I have a few tulips in my garden. Now, I have a garden. I guess I could call myself a gardener, but I don't know much about gardening, except what I've learned from just doing it. So I'm not sure why this happens, and maybe you guys know, but sometimes I plant tulips and they come up the first year and they're amazing, and then the next year they're not. But some tulips that I have in the garden, and it mostly seems to be like the yellow and the red ones, are the same, or are mostly kind of the same year after year. Like they're pretty predictable. They seem to have kind of settled in. But I did.
They have strong genetics.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it must be have some, right? It's something.
No, they literally have like strong original genetics, which is why they're the ones that you're seeing more consistently.
Yeah, I tried to plant some Bella Pox, not knowing. And the first year they were, their usual weird selves, but the next year they were just little stunted things. So I've learned that although some of the tulips in my garden, I mostly get tulips from a local flower farmer who has so many beautiful varieties. I love working with tulips the same way that I love working with peonies and roses, because they have these incredible light emit not emitting, like these sort of translucent, light, loving petals. So they look great with the light coming from the side, because the light kind of shines through the petals, but not quite. So they look like stained glass, if you get them just right. So that's why I love to work with tulips. And that's why mostly I like to work with tulips that are not yellow, because the yellow tulips, you can't see that effect because they're already yellow. I love to work with the sort of off color ones, the weird colors. And although, any tulip is a good tulip for me. So I think the reason why I'm attracted to tulips is the reason why I'm attracted to certain other flowers, is because of the way that light shines through the petals, especially when it's coming from the side, which is where the light comes from in my studio. And I do have a couple of varieties that are my favorites, but I most of the time I don't know the names of the tulips. There was a couple that I worked with one year called Brown Sugar, and another one called Copper Image, and I thought those were both pretty fun.
Yeah, and I noticed, you're using like a lot of parrots and like the really full doubles, the things that kind of, I don't know, they have the most detail. They bring the most fullness and weight to your image. And it's so interesting, as Linda was starting to say, our customers, I'll get these emails from people saying, they'll send a picture. I just bought these, parrot tulips, and I'm really disappointed. And they'll send me a picture, and they're in like a 6-inch tall vase, and the tulips are like 18 inches tall, and the blooms are just, they're so luscious and so weighty, and they're not getting the support they need to be doing what the customer wants them to do. And it's just so interesting, when I bring them home, I think about what are they doing naturally, like if I just hold them in front of myself, and then, what do I want them to do, and then I adjust them and the vase that I'm using, the vessel I'm using to get them to perform how I want them to. But I think people, like Linda said, are so used to thinking about tulips as like these, straight upright, the classic Darwinian, single tulip that will stand straighter in most any vase. And then you get into the varietals, like the doubles and the parrots and the fringes, and they can have more narrow stems and just be a little more elegant and dramatic in their habit. And that's what I'm seeing in your work. And just wondering, how much do let them fall the way they fall, or how much are you manipulating them in what you're creating, and how do you work with those flowers?
I am learning as I go. I had to learn a lot about like how to support flowers. I cheat quite a bit because of support. Sometimes I'll have like my main vase and another vase behind it that you can't see, so that I can, have like a taller vase so I can have things higher up in the composition. I love it when tulips keep growing. So I love it when they have these sort of weirdo shapes. I love the weirdo petals. And I guess because what I'm going for in a composition is a little bit wild. It's a little bit natural. It's a little bit unusual. And I don't really want it to look like there are so many florists who do these beautiful compositions with flowers. And I think what they're going for is that they want to show the kind of work that they can do arranging the flowers. But I'm going for a slightly different angle. And that is that it's not really supposed to be about the floral arranging, but the flowers themselves and the whole composition. And so sometimes I think that my compositions are a little bit awkward. And I kind of like that. I like them to be maybe a tiny bit imbalanced or odd. And I love the way that the stems are go off careening in a odd direction. I like when things overlap and they're not, I don't mind the awkward stuff. I kind of go with it. But I mean, there's so many times when I'm working with flowers and they're just not behaving the way I want them to. And I have to give up a little bit. And because they're flowers, I'm not, I'm not working with nails or sticks or 2x4s. I'm working with flowers and they have their own agenda. They're like children, right? You can't necessarily force them into how you need them to be. So and that's good. That's good. I want that natural feel to the arrangement and to the photograph in the end. Tulips are great at that. They're not, dahlias have these really firm stems. And they're very straight and they go where you want them to, but tulips are not like that. And so then you can, then you just have to, I just find you, I just have to listen to the flowers a little bit more and let them do what they want. But yeah, they do need a good amount of support, some extra chicken wire or a skewer or whatever. I'm not too proud to use whatever tool is at hand in order to make them stay where I need them to stay for the amount of time that I've got this arrangement. But if I have tulips in my home, yeah, I have a nice tall vase and only a little bit of water, and the water is cold and I change it every day. But I love watching how the flowers change over the 2 weeks that I have them. If they're good, fresh local flowers, they have a really good life, a nice long life. Mm-hmm. Especially when they totally open their hearts, like right before the petals fall down. It's just like, they're just so big and vulnerable and gorgeous. I love that.
We love that too.
Yeah.
I even love them like when they've dried and they have that iridescence to them. They're papery. Like, I'm so busy that like, I'll have like little mason jars of the take-home flowers everywhere in my house, and they'll dry up and be crispy, but they're still so beautiful in the way the light catches even those dried out petals.
Do you put like a pin frog? Do you use pin frogs too? Is that a part of your regular setup? Yeah,
pin frogs, chicken wire, sort of settled into the bowl or the vase. If I really need something to land exactly at a certain point in the composition, and then I'll use like a barbecue skewer. What else do I use? Yeah, sometimes I'll layer the vases, so I'll have my main vase in the front that you can see in the photograph, and then I'll have something behind in order to have a taller flower behind. I'll just, I approach it like a sculpture. And I almost feel like the photography is like a secondary part of it. It's not even like I have to do that in order for everyone to see what I'm working on. But but really the art form is the sculpture that I'm making with flowers and natural things in the studio.
When you're done with your photograph, does your work, does it just kind of decay there on your night table? I'm imagining you like exploring it, or do you clean it all up and, you know, put everything away right away?
You know, there's a certain point at which I just get sick of it, not sick of it, but just like, I just feel done. I just feel really done. Mm-hmm. And so, I usually take a couple of days to work on it. You know, I'll set it up one day and I'll shoot it a little bit and I'll wait for evening. And then the next day the flowers will open a little bit more. And so I'll shoot it again. And then I wait for the right light in the evening. And some, maybe I'll even get a third day out of it. But things move a lot with flowers, right? In a vase, they're moving all the time. And so it just, at a certain point, I'm just like, I've got it. I've got the photo that I want. And usually I have to pack for camping or something. I have to do something else. Like I have to, I have to get going. I have to get out of there. So I let them die on my mantelpiece or on my front cupboard by my front door. And that's where I usually, you know, watch them die. I don't have a lot of like, you know, it's funny. Again, I love contrast. So if there's a lot of like dead and dying things in my compositions, or there's a dead bird, I don't really want the flowers to look dead as well. Like, I really want them to be like at the peak of their juiciness, right?
I love that juiciness. What a great descriptor. Emily, do you have any other questions for Kristen?
I guess one of the things that we didn't really cover was, you know, what do you do with your art? Are you selling it? Are you doing exhibitions? Where do these pieces end up?
I like to print them really large, which is kind of another contrast, right? Because the original pieces are very small in a very small studio, and I try to print them really big. Not always. I also have a web page on my website, and there are sort of very affordable sizes there, a couple of different sizes. And so I sort of switched that up. It's like a little online gallery of my own. And I switch those pieces out every season. So it changes every time the season switches. But I do also work with a couple of galleries. This past year with the pandemic changed how it was supposed to go, but there are a couple of galleries that carry my work in Toronto, in the UK, and in Australia. And the sort of larger pieces, framed pieces, tend to be sold in those situations. I think it's interacting with the pieces in person is an important way to kind of feel connected to them. So the galleries and the art fairs kind of take the larger pieces, and if I'm going to sell a piece, it's usually some of the smaller ones online. There are four pieces hanging in a gallery in Toronto right now. And I went to visit them, you know, because it's nice to see them finally finished. There are printed pieces, and they're usually framed. I have a couple ways that I frame them, and then they're shown in either shows or art fairs or galleries or something like that.
And where do people find you if they're listening to this podcast and they want to see your work, or they might want to purchase some? How should they find you?
You know, if you follow me on Instagram, then you can kind of see what I'm working on a daily basis. And that's just KSJAAR on Instagram. I have a website, and I'm the only Kristen Sharda on that you can Google, as far as I know. So, if you spell my name correctly, you can find me. My last name is spelled S J AARDA, and the S and the J are said like an S and H, but you don't need that for Googling. So you can find me on my website, and then I have a couple galleries I work with, but you could find those through my website or my Instagram as well.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us this afternoon. And it's really interesting, I think, for us to step away from all this tulip farming that we've been doing lately and to talk about tulips more from the perspective of the consumer or someone who's enjoying them in their home or who's arranging them and trying to really, you know, see all those beautiful ephemeral qualities that you explained. And it's so lovely to, I think, you know, maybe for some of our listeners to be able to pair some of the tulips that they may be buying from us or that they may be finding from their own local flower farmer with your work and to kind of see, oh, this apricot parrot, this is what it could be if it was in Kristen's hands, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think we encourage people to look at Kristen's work so they can see the potential that some of these tulips have in an arrangement.
Yeah. Love talking about flowers and art, guys. Thanks very much for inviting me. I'm really honored. And, you know, I could probably spend 3 more hours asking you guys questions about your farms and your flowers and your techniques and your discoveries. It's great what you're doing. It's fascinating.
Oh, thank you. We wish we could send some to you. Yes, maybe when the border opens back up again, we'll be able to send some to you or bring some to you someday. That would be really wonderful.
Yeah, it'd be great to see you again.
Or you should come visit our farms when the borders are open too. That would be
lovely. I would love that. I would love that.
All right. Thank you so much, Kristen.
Thanks, Emily. Thanks, Linda.
Thanks again for listening, and be sure to share your questions and ideas for future episodes. You can reach us at frostonflowerspodcast@gmail.com.
This podcast is produced and edited by Brad DiArco. We're so grateful for his help. We'll catch you next time for another cool episode of the Frost on Flowers podcast.